Just a quick thing before we go on. I'm talking from the future here now, in full disclosure. Richard turned out to tell us so many amazing stories that we've decided to chop this one into a two-parter because we didn't want to edit any of the good yarns that he told us out. So stick with us on this one because there'll be a lot more to come after this episode's finished.
Right, I'll just rattle through these. Okay. Hello, I'm Richard Hawley. Welcome to season two of the Mojo Record Club.
Hi, you're listening to the Mojo Record Club, a place where music lovers, musicians, crate diggers, writers, readers, and special guests get to share their love for classic albums, weird lost gems, and brand new revelations. Andrew Mail is a bit under the weather today.
Oh, shit.
So this is John Mulvey hosting our latest Mojo podcast in the company of our special guest, Richard Hawley. Richard, welcome to the Mojo Record Club.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm going to rehearsal after this, and then we're on tour. So, last day of rehearsal, then pack some clothes and fuck off, you know.
Where's the first show?
We're doing a warm-up in Bangor.
Okay.
Yeah. It's how every great rock and roll tour starts off, in Bangor, you know. But they wanted me to play in fucking Grimsby, but I went, no. Find me somewhere more glamorous. So we found Bangor. Like, oh, that's, yeah. Well, my wife's Welsh, so that works. You know what I mean?
He's never a fan of Grimsby. I used to go to Cleethorpes when I was a kid, I always thought Cleethorpes was deluding itself by pretending that it wasn't Grimsby. Really?
But, yeah. The funny thing about Cleethorpes is that when all our neighbours in the 70s, when all the, you're too young to remember all this, but when the Freddie Laker...
No, I'm the same age as you.
Oh, so you remember when the Freddie Laker flat started, you know, where everybody could go anywhere kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
not us. But anyway.
No, and the same here, Mablethorpe, Cleethorpes, you know what I mean? Chapel St. Leonard's.
Yeah.
Is all the neighbours, you know, leaning over the garden wall. Like, oh, where have you been to holiday? Oh, we went to Portugal. Oh, where did you go? We went to Greece. And I heard my Auntie Evelyn go, we went to Clethrapes. As if it was like a Greek town, you know. True story. Yeah.
You're listening to the Mojo Record Club with me, Richard Hawley.
Richard Hawley has been making music since the mid-80s when he was still at school. Since then, the Sheffield songwriter has played with Long Pigs, with Pulp, and mostly as a solo artist. He's released 9 studio albums that have shown him to be adept at everything from string-drenched romanticism to big Gibson vibrato rockers and haunted works of nocturnal rumination. He's played with everyone from Nancy Sinatra and Hank Marvin to Lisa Marie Presley and the Arctic Monkeys. He currently has a multi-award-winning musical, Standing at the Sky's Edge, on at the National Theatre in London. And his new album, In the City They Call You Love, is released on May the 31st on BMG Records. Here's the latest track to be released from the album, a beautiful Buddy Holly-esque ballad of loneliness and belonging called Prism in Jeans, written by Richard Hawley and released on BMG Records.
And the wind blows back. Catch the first train smoking and never look back. I'll be gone. I don't belong. I'm trying to get where I understand. I'm counting stars and I'm counting sand to belong. I don't belong.
Richard, before I ask about the wider themes of this new record, can you tell me where the image of a prism in jeans came from? It's not your standard description of someone.
No, it's just kind of like someone walking around the street who looks kind of a bit dull, or maybe, or just, you know, you'd kind of walk past somebody and just not think anything about them. But is, you know, it's about to do with our thinking. You know, that someone could literally be a rainbow of a human being and just walking around in a pair of boring jeans and a T-shirt. It's that kind of thing, really. You don't really know what's going off inside someone's mind, obviously. But all of us, every human being, it's a natural thing, actually, to walk past somebody and make immediate judgments about someone. you know, short, fat, thin, you know, whatever the fuck it is. And we all do it with our yes, no synapses. That, I mean, you get social media now where people just print what that goes off in their brain and it immediately goes to their fingers without thinking about it. And but those thoughts do go off in the human mind. And I actually read a psychology book about this. My wife's a psychiatric nurse. And she said that we make these judgments because of our DNA. It's to do with our survival mechanisms and stuff, you know. And also certain people will fit with others in a genetic way or a social way or lots of other factors that make you attracted to someone or not attracted to somebody. And you keep all this in your mind, and a lot of it is, you know, it's just immediate judgments that are not something that that you need to say. But obviously, I mean, in the modern world, that's no longer applicable. But I don't do social media. So it's just about someone who basically you might misjudge by just walking past them, and they literally could change your life if you actually spent 5 minutes with them, you know.
Do you find as you get older that you're better at controlling those snap judgments or worse?
Better, for me personally, I think because I've never had the social media experience, this modern kind of thing, and I'm not blaming social media on anything. It's obviously incredibly useful for a lot of reasons, but it's just something that doesn't interest me, probably because I would be very quickly, I don't drive a car, you know, and I'm quite, most of the time, quite a calm person. But I think if I got behind a wheel, I would immediately turn into one of those ranting, get out of my way, bing, bing, move, you know. And it wouldn't take long for me to do that. So I remember discussing the social media thing with my kids when it first came out, and they just said, Dad, no. and that was that. I took that advice and just basically never engaged. But, yeah, I think I actually like spending time talking to people, especially when I'm in a pub. You know, you just meet random people, and some people are interested in who I am, or you're Richard Hawley or whatever, and some people don't give a shit, you know. And actually, I drink in this very, very old family social club that's close to our house, and it's just filled with septuagenarians and octogenarians, and they don't give a shit. I mean, if Tom Hanks and Elvis walked through the door, they wouldn't care, because they're all in God's waiting room. Well, we all are, but you know, is that they've got a lot more important things on their mind than worrying about what you do, you know. And I think ever since I was a kid, when I used to go to working men's clubs and social clubs or whatever with my family, is that my favourite times were always sat around listening to old people's stories. They were amazing and far more interesting than most of the kids my age, you know, because we hadn't had a life yet, you know. So, yeah, I hope I'm getting better and being more tolerant. You know, in the world that we live in, it's insane and absolutely intolerant, you know. And within seconds, people can pull a gun on you, you know.
Do you think that it strikes me that this is critical to a lot of the music you've made as a solo artist, that there's a respect for social history and cultural traditions of where you're from that's embedded in your music?
Well, it's embedded in me, you know, so it's going to come out in anything I do. You know, if I was a graffiti artist or, you know, scrolling on a wall or, you know, writing a play or something, or even just writing for myself, which actually is what I do really, it's just a lot of people have got involved now. I just try and write music that's got some level of a granule of truth in it, you know, or at least my truth, you know, so that if you believe in something that you're doing and you know that there's a reason why you're doing what you're doing, you know that it's going to connect with some other folks out there too. You know, that was something I learned really early on.
Maybe that's something that's become even more pronounced with the success of your musical at this point.
Well, that's a strange thing, because I, you know, I never thought that that would leave the inside of my head, let alone end up where it's ended up, because of the colloquial nature of it, that I thought, well, maybe we might get like a week run, you know, like as in 1 week, not W-E-A-K. you know, it'll be on at the Crucible, the local theatre for a week maybe. And because it's pretty heavy, what he's talking about. Or, well, the end message isn't, I guess. But the journey to get to that point is a heavy view, you know. It's not a, you can't watch that, I don't think, and not be affected by it, because it's heavy in its nature. But yeah, is like I've said this a thousand times before, probably in interviews, is, you know, John, is I don't know what it's like to live in Bangladesh or Atlanta, Georgia, or the North Pole or the moon, but I know what it's like to live in Sheffield. And it's just simple as that, you know. Lou Reed did it with New York, you know. There's loads of writers that wrote about where they were brought up and where they lived. It seems to be, it's more weird to me that people don't do that.
Right.
You know, because music is a kind of a fantastical thing and a fantasy in a way. And it makes the brain operate in a way that no other thing on earth does, because you can't touch music. You know, you can analyze it with, because it's alphabetical and numerical, it's numbers and letters. If you play an instrument, you know that the key, right, whatever key you're in, like A or C or whatever, and it all has numbers that go from, you know, a root note to an octave is eight notes, you know, so it's maths and letters. But music is completely indefinable. You cannot touch it. It's like oxygen, you know. A scientist can tell us what's going off, but how it affects the human brain and the emotions and chemicals that it releases in our mind that make us feel certain things, it's in and undefinable, you know.
Right, yeah. One thing that I always wonder, and one thing that I think is quite notable about what you do, though, is for all of the successful and famous and excellent musicians that have come from Sheffield, perhaps not so many of them have actually articulated or written specifically about Sheffield. It's like, I think about Manchester musicians and the mythologizing of Manchester seems to be a sort of many of their starting points. But with Sheffield, it feels like people are a bit more wary of writing about the city and writing about the culture there, or they write about it in more elusive and non-specific ways.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, I can think of one example, which is obviously our kid, Jarvis.
Yeah, Sheffield, you know, Sex City. Yeah,
that's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah. And there's lots of references, and Arctic Monkeys did it as well, you know.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. It's in general, I think it's probably it's not as specific, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up about 20 miles from Sheffield, and so I was listening in the early 80s to the local music shows on BBC.
Where was that, John?
Retford.
All right, yeah.
Well, I was born in Sheffield, but I grew up about 20 miles away. And I used to listen to the radio shows in the early mid-80s from the city. And so much of the music that was being made there was had this kind of hard-edged futurism to it. And I don't mean futurist in the kind of new romantic way necessarily, but I mean things more like those post-Cabaret Voltaire bands and that kind of thing that seemed massively prevalent in the city around that time.
Well, D Boyle the drummer ended up being in the Long Pigs with me, you know. And
I did not know that, really. Okay.
Yeah, he was Chuck's drummer, and he played for Cabaret Voltaire as well, amongst a whole host of other amazing. He played with Adrian Sherwood and Tackhead and stuff like that.
Oh wow, okay.
He's a phenomenal drummer.
But those musicians, obviously they represented something about Sheffield's industrial heritage and sort of backbone. I suppose it wasn't heritage when they started. It was still a sort of living part of the city, and rather than a sort of, but it wasn't singing about Cole's Corner.
Yeah. No, but I don't know. Maybe it's a it's relevant or maybe it's irrelevant, but the only thing I would observation I would proffer to you as about those particular bands, not all of them, but Chuck in particular, they were all students that stayed.
Okay, right.
They, I think they weren't actually from D, the drummer was from Rotherham. Poor bastard. And that was an interesting perspective in a way that you'd got students that were looking at and using the industrial framework of Sheffield to create that kind of industrial funk or whatever they called it.
Yeah.
But none of them were actually from here. You know?
Interesting. Yeah.
The producer was Rob Gordon. Yeah. He's from Sheffield. Brilliant kid. Yeah. Genius as well.
And then all the Warp stuff, I guess, was similar in some ways.
Well, they were all from Sheffield, all that lot.
Yeah.
You know,
LFO, Robin. Yeah.
Rob and Steve and that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just changing the subject, one thing you told us in the last interview you did with Mojo was that all the guitar solos on the new album were played on Scott Walker's old Telecaster.
Some of them, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's a... Well, do you want to know the story about that?
Yeah, I'd love it, please. Yeah,
is it wasn't something that me and Scott needed to talk about, I guess. And I asked permission from Lee's daughter and Kathy. I said, it wasn't permission. It was, do you want me to talk about this in interviews? Because I've played Scott's guitar on the record, and are you comfortable with that? You know, I asked, it's not something I'm trying to self-aggrandize, and they were very much into the idea, we want you to talk about it, to keep his anything alive, not that I need to contribute towards that. Sure. Scott's music will live forever. But it was a beautiful gift, and basically I met Scott first when he produced the last Pulp record.
Yeah.
And basically, Scott was an old session player, and from the late 50s and early 60s, and he had a work ethic that was very old-fashioned, and he was great because he was a hard worker, and I was a session player for a long time, and also. Like him, from a certain strict kind of background that where you had to, you didn't get something for free, you had to fucking work for it, And I found all this out later. But anyway, so I was supposed to turn up, and it was, start in the studio at the crack of noon. and you had to be there on time, and it was a Monday morning, the session, and I'd turned up on the Sunday evening with all my shit, set it up, it was all working, ready to go, tuned up, and all I had to do was turn up in the morning, retune the guitars, I knew what I was doing, I'm ready to go. I'm going to do this stuff, I'm going to be in and out of the studio in 4 hours,
Yeah.
It didn't work out like that because next door to this studio was, I think it was in Metropolis in London, I think, or one of those old big studios,
Yeah.
Anyway, there was a record shop next door to the studio, and I saw this sign as I was walking into the studio, last day closing, everything must go. And it was just, oh, fuck. And I looked in the window, and there was all these Eddie Cochran EPs, LPs, Gene Vincent, all 50 stuff that I loved, in mint condition, all in the record.
Wow.
So and they were for buttons. And I just went in this shop and did a supermarket sweep kind of thing, just looked through things. This was at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Because it had just opened. And I got lost in time. And I ended up turning up at about 12:15. What, not massively late, but 15 minutes with this fucking massive pile of records. I said to Steve, Mackie and Jarvis at the time, fucking hell, lads, help me in with this lot, will you? And they helped me in, and I put them on this island that was at the back of the mixing desk. And Scott was at the mixing desk with his baseball cap pulled down like that. And he just says, you're late. I just went, shit, it's not a great start. Working with one of your heroes,
Yeah.
I thought, this guy's pissed off with me already. And Jarve and Steve were looking through the records and going, fucking hell, that's great. Oh, wow, and all this. And then Scott goes, okay, let's have a look at what you got. And then he came up and started looking through the records, and he pulled out this Eddie Cochran EP that had got Something Else on it. as the lead track, and it was on London American Records. And this sums him up in a lot of ways. His mood changed immediately. And actually with me, it never changed back. It was always, he was really happy. And he goes, oh man, I played on that record, you know. and then he said to me, and this was a God's gospel truth, and he said, hey, Richard, do you want to meet Eddie Cochran? And I went, well, yeah, but he's been dead a long time. And he goes, I played with Eddie. He told me it was, I'll stop the American accent. He played with Eddie in the very late 50s in Gold Star Records playing bass for him. And this blew my mind. I don't even sat in the studio fucking 10 minutes. And he said, okay, shake my hand. And he said, through me, you're shaking Eddie Cochran's hand. Because the last thing Eddie did when he left the studio was thank Scott for great bass playing. And I was like, you fucking hell. I've not even played a note and I'm already shaking Eddie Cochran's hand via the conduit of Scott Walker. And then, anyway, I did the session and he was really happy with it. And I said, is that okay? And he said these words that he kept repeating to me over the years. He said, you bring it, Richard. It was beautiful. I was nearly crying. And that was the greatest compliment you could get from a master musician. And I remember there's this track on this Pulp record called Bob Lind. And it's 12-string acoustic, really fast picking. And I guess one of the few people the Pulp lot knew who could do that. And I thought I was playing pretty good. And then Scott said to me, he just goes, dig in. Dig in. And I remember my fingers were nearly bleeding at the end of it, but it sounded great. But he made me play it with a lot of attack. And you know, it made the rhythm of the track move a lot faster in a very subtle way. And anyway, I split from the session, went back home, and Scott got my email address from Jarvis. And he just kept emailing now and again. And then we stayed in touch. No big shakes and not in, I certainly wasn't going to be in his face. It's not a thing I'd do.
Yeah.
And I was playing some gig in London. I can't remember. Roundhouse it was. And Scott said, I want to come. So I said, yeah, no problem. Got him tickets, all like that. And him and his Mrs. Bev, they came and hung out in the dressing room. And it was kind of after that point that he'd get in touch more because we hung out socially. And then he'd just ring me up. He got my phone number and he'd just go, whenever you're in London, just give me a call and we'll go for a pint. And he loved Guinness and he loved darts, playing darts. And I'm a shit darts player, but I'm a fair pool player. So we'd have a trade-off. We'd have a few games of darts and then a couple of frames of pool. And he'd kick my ass with darts, but I'd hammer him at pool. And you know, he was a shit pool player.
You're listening to the Mojo Record Club.
I should at this late date be aware that people who appear enigmatic are not always quite as mysterious and as it was. But
that was part of it, John, you know.
Yeah.
It was part of it because his creative life, he was very, and his personal life, he was immensely protective of.
Yeah.
And he knew, I think the reason why he let me in, because he knew with the people I'd worked with in the past, I guess, that he knew I wasn't going to betray him.
Yeah.
You know, and these stories, now he's gone, and I've spoke to his daughter Lee and Kathy, his manager, and is there happy for me to discuss things like this. And it's truthful and loving as well, because he was a lovely man. And he listened. He wasn't just a bullshitter or just the me thing. He was great at that. And anyway, you'll have to edit the shit out.
No, absolutely will not be editing this.
But
I
then
show you.
It was kind of kismet or fate or whatever, or just pure chance. But it was 3 days into the beginning of the recording of the record. And the album was so short to record. It was over a 2-month period. But it wasn't in there every day, you know. We were had days off, or the guys were doing other things, and it was over a 2-month period, probably using maybe 4 or 5 weeks of that time to record and mix the record. Anyway, 3 days into recording the new record, Kathy rang me up and she said they'd sorted all Scott's estate out, and which had taken a while, and Lee, his daughter, had read his will, and in the will, it wasn't specific, he just said, make sure Richard gets one of my guitars. And they rang me and said, which one would you like? And I said, his white Telecaster is the one. I'd use it, you see, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then they got, it was one of Lee's friends from Denmark. I don't think he's even a musician. And he brought it over on the plane from Denmark in a soft gig bag. Fucking. And he put it in the overhead locker.
Oh, my God.
The bulkhead. And he brought it to me, just delivered it to the studio. We had a cup of tea together and a chat. And then he fucked off back to Denmark and I was left with his guitar. And I started playing it. And I don't use instruments out of sentiment. I use them if they're good.
Yeah.
You know, and it had not been played for a very long time. So my guitar tech, Gordon White, he fixed it up, which was a big decision to do, actually, because there was still Scott on there, you know, old strings that had got his...
Right, yeah.
You know, all that. But they went in the bin, no sentiment, and Scott would have hated that.
Yeah.
And cleaned it up and made it play, and I just started playing it. And the first thing I played was the solo on Deep Space, which was through this... I didn't use it because of this, because of the time, but it's a fuzz and wah pedal from the 60s, early 70s, called a Poltava fuzz, that greatly affected the sound of the record. Nothing else sounds like it, because it was an Eastern European pedal that was trying to be a kind of American pedal, but
right.
In the process of doing it, they got it wrong. But a bit like the Rolling Stones trying to copy the R&B artist, they couldn't copy Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, but they invented something new, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of theory. And this pedal, and I played it with Scott's guitar, and it just sounded immense. Is immense through an old Watkins Scout amp, a 58. There's a tiny little amp like that. It's 10 watts. It sounds massive, you know. So that's the story with Scott's guitar.
It's a pretty good one. I want to talk very swiftly about one other track on the album, because I think it gives us a nice kind of springboard to the record that you brought in today to discuss. Mm. So one track is called Hear That Lonesome Whistle Blow, which is maybe one of the closest that you've got to a kind of a country song, a more orthodox country song.
Yeah, I think so. It kind of that was the first song that I wrote that I used on the record, because I write all the time. It's not that I write for specific things. I write because there's all this stuff in my head. And like my wife says, who's a psychiatric nurse, she said, you know, it's not because you're talented, it's because you're fucking mental.
Hope she doesn't talk like that in her day job.
No, she doesn't. No, yeah, she's very professional. but it's not a talent, it's probably a mental illness. But that song was actually one of the first things that I came up with when I got asked to do the film with Wes Anderson and Jarvis.
You know? Oh, right, yeah. Asteroid City, yeah.
Yeah, and I sort of came up with that. That was the first thing. And we went somewhere else with that. It was something, I think, I mean, the song, the particular, the Dear Alien thing, he kind of wanted something that was a sort of twisted Walt Disney thing, I guess.
Yeah.
So anyway, I didn't even play them that song. But that influence and stuff comes from this kind of stuff.
Richard is holding up. I'll do a kind of audio commentary here. He's holding up the Fantastic Expedition of Dillard and Clark by Doug Dillard and Gene Clark, released on A&M Records in 1968, which is the record that you wanted to talk about today.
Yeah, well, this copy is actually my dad's, and. Should we talk about the record?
Well, let's. Before we do that, I thought what we could do is we could play a little bit of Hear That Lonesome Whistle Blow, written by Richard Hawley and released on BMG Records, and then segue into one of my favourite tracks from the Dillard and Clark LP, Train Leaves Here This Morning.
Oh, it's awesome.
Written by Gene Clark and Bernie Ledden. So
yeah, from the Eagles, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So let's do that.
That lonesome whistle blow, the sound of someone feeling low. If the night wasn't so long, then I'd be gone. If the night wasn't so near, that lonesome whistle blow. Columbus was the address I had written on my sleeve. I don't know just what she wanted, might have been that it was getting tired.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, it doesn't seem so strange to me to connect those things, because from childhood, you know, my family background, all the men in my family were steelworkers. All the women were nurses, and you know, the growing up in a steel town and having the trains and the mountains, because we live on seven hills in Sheffield. There's the mountains and the rivers, and it's all truncated in a smaller kind of thing than the great American landscape. But the subject matter, and I mean, this is this record is rooted deeply in bluegrass.
Yeah.
That because Doug Dillard, you know, they weren't fakers. Doug Dillard and the Dillards were the real deal. You know, they weren't just like kind of some hippies who'd smoked a bit of weed and decided to pick up a banjo. You know, they were steeped in it. And I grew up listening to Dad and Mum's record collection, which you've got the Stanley Brothers, the Osborne Brothers. You know, it goes on and on and on. And loads of bluegrass and country stuff that I grew up with, and Dad played that record loads, and my ears would prick up with it but it sounded different to what I was into at the time. And when I was about 16, I started getting into the Byrds.
Yeah,
and Dad said, "They're great, the Byrds, but you should listen to this album." And the thing at that age that turned me on the first was the fact that, I mean, I figured out later that they're handing each other a joint anyway, you know, there. That's what's going off.
Yeah.
But it was the fact that they were wearing Marlon Brando caps, and that the motorbike, it's a late 50s, I think it's a late 50s Harley Davidson Electroglide, which is a really beautiful, I don't drive them, but aesthetically they're incredibly beautiful things. And the fact that Gene Clark was the original lead singer of the Byrds, I thought, okay, I'll check this record out. And immediately, even at that age, you could hear that Gene Clark was swimming a deeper current. He was swimming in a much, much deeper current than the pop music of the Byrds, even though it was folk rock and there was some wonderful music created by the Byrds. But there's something in this record that mines a deeper current. And now that I've listened to it and obviously learned quite a bit, actually, out of your magazine, Mojo, about it, stuff that I didn't know. And Bernie Ledden from the Eagles, they were really early on in his kind of trajectory.
Before the Burritos, never mind, Eagles.
Well, that you know, the Byrds were such a huge influence on so much that came after, you know.
Yeah.
And Gene Clark in particular. I think that the reason why this record has got the atmosphere it has is because Doug Dillard and Gene Clark had both at the same time left their previous bands. Doug Dillard left his brothers, you know, the Dillards, and obviously Gene had left the Byrds for the second time, in fact.
Yeah, because he'd been with the Gosdins before, hadn't they? And then he'd gone back very briefly.
That's another great record.
Yeah.
You know, and ironically, a bird that refused to fly.
Yeah, yeah.
He was terrified of flying.
Yeah.
There was no promotion into this record. He played one gig at the Troubadour in LA. I've heard that they played a few more shows, but they were more like bluegrass kind of barn dance.
Right, yeah.
Get-togethers. But it's got that sort of atmosphere. Late at night, people are getting together, just hanging out and playing. It's the lack of formality of it that's so attractive, and those kind of esoteric, slightly unhinged, well, stoned. You know, but it's not unhinged. It's very hinged, actually. That's not the right word. They're not disconnected either. They're just tuning into a different emotional level that we don't manage to get to every single day. All of us. And the fact that he refused to kind of promote it, and he refused to tour it as well.
Yeah.
Because you know, he'd had all that shit with the birds and just didn't want to do that again and wanted to try and find something new. And I think Doug Dillard was possibly the same. But there was heavyweight musicians involved in this, you know, really serious players. But it's the relaxed nature of how they're playing. No one's trying to outplay each other. They're all complimenting the song.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect record for me. I love it so much. And the fact that it was a gift from my dad means a lot to me. And it's one of the few records that I managed to set. There was a big, during the steel strikes, dad had to sell all his records and he got some amazing records. And I kept this one. Elvis Rock and Roll number 1 and 2, both of them original albums. And I kept Tim Rose's first album.
Oh, wow. Morning.
And those records shaped my life. And Fats Domino as well, the fantastic, the fabulous Mr. D. I kept that album and managed to sneak them under my bed. And I think my dad knew. But anyway, it's just that my dad would give me stuff and it would be really off the cuff. My dad would say, oh, you should listen to that, you like it. And if dad said that, I took notice because it was kind of, he wouldn't sit there and lecture me why and go, this is why you should be doing this. And he'd just go, that's a great record, that son. I think you'll get something from it.
Yeah.
And when he said stuff like that, I knew it was worth my time. So I love it, this record, so much. It's and the first track that I love was Out on the Side. It was a transitional,
amazing. Yeah,
a transitional track from being a Birds fan with the kind of psychedelic mixture of that and the folk and country stuff, that the guitar playing on that at the end section of it when it goes into those triplets that on electric guitar, that you could hear there was a connection between the bluegrass stuff and the kind of Younger Than Yesterday era,
yeah, maybe,
you
yeah.
know, that sort of era. And then it just goes off into the backing music, the instrumentation of the album is pretty straight bluegrass all the way through. That's the origins of it, I would say. And the fact it's got banjos and acoustic guitars, it's roots, deep roots music. But it's the lyrical content of it that where it just goes, whoa, bluegrass never went there, you know.
Yeah, but it's also it feels like the natural endpoint of a trajectory that Gene Clark was on. I mean, it's not like he was a pop star who'd suddenly affected an interest in country music and bluegrass. These, you know, yeah. as with all of the birds, the vast majority of the birds, this is the music that they were to a greater or lesser degree rooted in before they became pop stars.
Absolutely.
And so it's almost like what they learned, or what Clark learned as writing hit records, he brought back to his original love and his original musical foundations. And that I think that's a critical reason why it works so well, because his songs are such a natural fit for that instrumentation, even though they're not technically orthodox bluegrass tunes.
I mean, it doesn't matter whether they are or not. There's a lot of bluegrass that claims to be that isn't, you know.
Right.
But, yeah. I mean, you can hear where he was going, or where, not even where he was going, where he was at with his writing and how his mind worked with lyrics. If you listen to that B-side that he wrote for the Birds, that She Don't Care About Time.
Amazing, yeah.
Which is probably my favourite Bird song. And it's got a great solo as well from Roger McGuinn. But it's an abstract looking at the ordinary through a cracked abstract mirror, you know, or window. He just had a beautiful turn of phrase. His writing was poetic and heartfelt without being greasy and over the top. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
The economy of words as well, where he kind of painted a picture just enough for you to paint your own, you know.
There's also something, I'm not a musician, so I can't articulate really what he does, but there's something unusual about the way his songs seem to work technically to me. They always feel like there's something quite spontaneous and simultaneously complex about the way that they melodically unravel. They don't work in a conventional way. It always seems every kind of bar or every sort of verse seems a bit too long than the norm. Do you know what I mean? They kind of unravel in quite an odd way, which is very kind of beautiful, really, I suppose, and unforced.
Yeah, I think a lot of I'm going to put this into the mix, but I think is a lot of that is to do with, I know that he listened to Chuck Berry a lot.
Okay.
And Chuck Berry's, you know, that.
Yeah.
Every beat of the bar. And I think Gene Clark's writing is a bit more measured in terms, I mean, the tempos, a lot of his stuff was slower, but it's got that thing, you know.
You've been listening to the Mojo Record Club with me, Richard Hawley.
Okay, as I mentioned at the start of the podcast, Richard just talked and talked with so many amazing yarns. So what we've done is we've made two podcasts out of this one interview. So hold tight and there'll be another one along pretty soon. Thank you for listening in the meantime. Please like, subscribe, yada yada, all the usual grift. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, folks, for listening to the Mojo Record.